Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we talk about the news from a sort of coffee table that spans multiple continents. That's the wonder of the internet. This is show number 17 for September 26th, 2009. And I didn't say 26th properly, but that doesn't matter. Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club. My name is Patrick Beja. I am your host, and this is the show, as you just heard, where we talk about the news, political, international, and so on. From different countries, different cultures, different people, but we generally have a good time. I have two wonderful hosts with me today. The one, of course, that you all know, Turkey from Saudi Arabia. I've missed you, Turkey. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Yeah?
Got a lot of news going on here in Saudi.
A lot of what?
A lot of news going on here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talk about this in a few minutes. I haven't spoken to you in what is it, like 2 months? It's weird. Now you're in the show all the time, so when you're not, it feels like something's missing.
Yeah, I listened to your last show. Dude, are you trying to gross us or what?
Jen, so you, I don't know if you've heard the previous show. It was a show called Girls for Dummies. And
listen to that one.
You did? Oh, yeah. Awesome. So let me introduce you first, and then you will tell us what you thought of the show. I hope it's going to be good. Jen is from Florida, and she's joining us for the first time today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. you listened to the show. What did you think as a woman?
I thought it was fantastic. Just here, especially, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that women are generally not supposed to talk about in situations about our bodies and our bits and stuff like that. And it was great to just hear conversations like, oh God, I totally understand that. That is totally how it is for me. And yeah, so that was great.
Awesome. Cool. I have Jen's seal of approval. Hopefully, you know, there was so much more I wanted to talk about, but I forgot half of it. And then there was not enough time, but I think Gita and Kelly did a great job. So if you haven't listened to it and you are not, as I said in the show, a 12-year-old who's like, oh, gross, I don't want to hear about that, then you can go listen to it and you might learn a thing or two. And we have the chat room, of course, who is here with us today. Hi, chat room. Thank you for being here on a Saturday, mostly morning, I'm guessing, for the people in the U.S., but maybe there are some people from other places, too. Thanks for being here. We might call on you for advice and opinion during the show. And just so you know, we were supposed to have another person with us today. My friend Kerwin, well, actually, Jen knows him too. That's the person who introduced us. Kerwin is in London at the moment, and he might be lost in the tube, as they say. He is supposed to be joining us, but we don't know where he is. So hopefully he will be joining us during the show, maybe. And if he doesn't, then it will be for next time. So this is a return to the regular show. And we are going to be starting with the international stories. And there are a couple of things I want to tackle. But first, before we go into a full-blown story, I want to mention something about swine flu, because it's now fall, and this is the season for swine flu. And I'm very surprised that, at least in France, we're not freaking out. Meaning we have, you know, PSAs, so public service announcements, and the government has lots of little mask things that they have reserves and vaccines and stuff like that. But people are not freaking out. So I want to know if possibly more in the U.S. the news are managing to get everyone up in arms and panicking.
Surprisingly enough, no. It's kind of strange. There are cases of swine flu, even here in Florida, actually. It's a bit of a hotbed for swine flu. I've got people I know personally that have come down with it. But
do you think that can be transmitted through the internet? Because I'm not wearing a mask.
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm willing to bet somewhere that it can be, and that'll be the end of it all. But, yeah, so I've got friends that have come down with it, and, you know, I happen to have a job that puts me at risk because I work as a teacher. But it just seems to me that there's been a lot of people just sort of decided that this was a hoaxy sort of blow-up that happened way back when it came out in the spring, when the news originally broke. And I think that there's been a lot of sort of backlash towards that to just say, oh, this isn't a big deal. But I do think that there is, it's starting to show up a little more and more in the news, things about the flu vaccine and Tamiflu, it turns out, being an ineffective or somehow a harmful vaccine to use for swine flu and things like that. So it's starting to show up again where people, now we're in the season where we're getting vaccinated and things. But surprisingly,
but people are being reasonable. That's weird.
Yeah, it is very strange.
especially in the U.S.
It's early days yet, though. Give it till October, you know, end of October, then we'll see where we're at.
By then, people will probably start freaking out.
Yeah, it'll be like SARS all over again.
Turkey, what about Saudi Arabia? Do you even have the swine flu?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge deal here, the swine flu. We even classes, the schools have been delayed, the opening for the next semester. And basically they pushed the classes back because they just wanted to educate the teachers before they started.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. That makes sense. But people, so it's a big deal, or it's a big deal and people are freaking out and, you know, what is this strange illness that's plaguing
us? Well, yeah, it depends on who you talk to. Yeah, there are a lot of people freaking out. There's some people who don't even care about it, like me. No big deal, just another flu. And there's those who are just freaking out like crazy and making a huge deal out of it. And basically, because we just have so many cases here, because we have the whole pilgrimage thing of Mecca, and we get a lot of foreigners, and that just resulted in a huge spread of the flu.
Right. And so, you were telling us about this a couple of months ago, actually.
Yeah, so it's really a big deal. The deaths cases are not really helping people relax, and apparently most people don't even know that people actually die from the regular flu. So for them, it's complete shock that someone is dying. So
yeah, okay. By the way, Kerwin joined us, and he was actually messaging me like crazy a few minutes ago, but I wasn't looking at the right account, so it's my fault. Kerwin, are you with us?
I think so.
Yes, you are. Victory! It works! It's alive! How are you doing, my friend?
I'm pretty good.
All right.
I have to make my apologies on behalf of Skype and Transport for London.
That's quite all right. So I did introduce you while you weren't there, but I think you never met Turkey, but you do know Jen, so we're going to skip the long introduction and dive directly into the question, which is, are the British freaking out about swine flu like everyone should, but no one apparently is?
It's interesting. I can give you a personal account of that.
Oh, my God. Do you have swine flu?
No, but I've been tested for it in London.
What?
I've been tested for it. So when the first confirmed cases arrived in the UK, then there started to be notices going up all over the university where I was studying at the time. Every lift well in particular had these large laminated notices about how to wash one's hand and how to cover one's face when one sneezes and things like that.
We actually have those in the offices in France too. So, but that's good measure. That's good. It's not.
Yeah. So, but on one of my exams, I came struck down with a very strong fever, and because I didn't want it to affect my marks, I needed to get a form of mitigating circumstances, a medical certificate, things like that. So I eventually made my way to one of the hospitals here, one of the emergency rooms. And when I presented myself and I told them that I had run a fever, she immediately wrote down flu-like symptoms on her board, and she pushed a little gas mask through the porthole, and she told me to put it on immediately, and then she sent me to a separate part of the waiting room.
Oh, you were quarantined.
I was quarantined as far as the emergency room goes, but then as I was there, as I was sitting waiting, and everyone walked past, all the patients who walked past who saw me with the gas mask got a little bit concerned. But there are these three doors in front of me.
Wait a second. When you're saying gas mask, is it like an actual thing that provides
gas mask might
to
be
you,
the wrong. No, okay. Gas mask is
surgical
the wrong word.
Mask. Surgical mask. Mask.
All right. Yes. I was having a funny picture of you in my head, but.
No, okay. My thing was just like a little paper filter.
Right. Okay.
However, as I was sitting, these sliding doors parted in front of me, and out from the examination room came a woman clad head to toe in blue plastic with a real gas mask on. I'm talking filter canisters on the side of her face.
Wow, like hazmat suit type stuff.
Yes, that's right. And that's how I was inspected. So I would say that the general public is not particularly alarmed, but the hospitals might be going a little bit overboard.
Oh, as long as, you know, they're taking the necessary precautions and
yes,
not freaking out, which, anyway, that's just a couple of words I wanted to ask you guys about, because I was just surprised that we're not freaking out, and apparently no one is freaking out. So I wonder why the world is suddenly taken by this strike of reasonableness. It's very strange.
Well, I might say one country.
Basically, because just people like me going out to people and explaining to them, for God's sake, it's only a flu, and there's more people who died from the regular flu than the swine flu till this day.
I guess so, but that's never stopped people from freaking out. You know, being reasonable is not the strong suit of the media in general, but.
I was going to say the other country where the response is a bit stronger is the Philippines, because I was spending a lot of time in the Philippines as the swine flu was breaking out. Government officials in any department are not allowed to see a foreigner until they've been in the country 10 days, the idea being that if the person has gone through 10 days within the country without having brought any symptoms into the country, they're safe. And I was needing to meet with a number of government officials, so that actually delayed a number of my appointments. And going into a lot of large office buildings, we were getting how temperatures checked on the way
really?
Into the building.
That's
yeah,
funny.
just to office buildings, like the headquarters of San Miguel Breweries, for example.
So my question would be, how do you get your temperature checked?
A couple of ways. There were, in some of the offices and even the condominium that I was staying in, there are handheld temperature scanners. They say, excuse me, sir, can you please look into this? Or they point the scanner to your forehead. And I guess it's a laser scanning the forehead reads, or heat sensor that reads
all
the...
Right. I was being facetious. I wasn't actually expecting an answer.
Right.
But.
Well, I think I know exactly what you wanted to hear.
No. What are you thinking?
I wonder what they're going to do with their president. She was just here. So what are they going to do to her when she's back?
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe she's going to have to be in a containment unit for 10 days.
Yeah, I think it'd be fine if she didn't speak to any government official for a few days.
All right, let's move on to the other big story, which is surprisingly not as big as I expected it to be. And then we'll talk about Pittsburgh and the G20. Let's mention the 9/11 anniversary / Afghan war and Afghan election that happened in the past month. So I'll start. I guess France is not the biggest place for 9/11 celebration. Well, not celebration, but commemoration. But I was surprised at how little we heard about it. It was barely mentioned. There was no special reports on TV or, you know, look back on what happened, why, how, etc., etc. The 9/11 is almost a non-event. It was this time at least, and I realize it's not. It's probably going to come back for the 10-year anniversary, and it's going to be brought back at some point. But it seems like we're almost over it here in France, at least. So obviously, this is not the U.S. It might be different there, but in France, it was a very small deal, and it was surprisingly small. Very quickly, Kerwin and Turkey, how was it for you guys? Kerwin first, I guess.
I don't think it made a peep in Britain either. Although I have to say, I happened to be in Paris on that particular
You're
day.
You're such an international man of mystery. Philippines, Paris, London.
Sorry, yes.
Can you say groovy?
Groovy.
There you go. All right, so not a huge deal for.
I don't think it was a huge deal in England at all. It's not been mentioned at all.
All right. I guess Turkey, it's always specifically different in Saudi Arabia, but.
Oh, yeah, sure. We had a huge parade, a carnival, a whole celebration.
I think we probably mentioned it before, but I have the memory of a goldfish. So what's your stance, official and people? I know it's always different for you guys in Saudi Arabia, regarding 9/11 and the attacks on the World Trade Center.
Oh, there's officially, it might have happened, but you shouldn't blame the entire country. Those were people who were tricked into doing that stuff, and they were educated and trained outside of Saudi Arabia. So you can't really blame Saudi.
So the government and the officials distanced themselves very clearly.
Yeah, and it's kind of a fact. They just bring facts that all of these Saudis who were part of these whole terrorist acts were taught outside of Saudi. They didn't really get all of their terrorist education here. So,
of course.
Yeah, and of course, all of their leaders were not Saudis, basically. So that's all. Unofficially, it depends on who you talk to, and
I think that's going to be your catchphrase. It's the one you use the most.
Because
no, I understand.
Those are facts, and it's really difficult to give an opinion about a majority of people when everybody has a different opinion. But overall, there's basically two main ideas, which is one, this whole thing is a lie. Either the whole thing is a lie, or people who think like me, it all happened. But for me personally, I believe the U.S. government knew it was going to happen. They just let it go along. So you have those opinions. And then you have the opinions that say, well, they deserved it. The Americans deserved it. So,
is that a strong thought or opinion in the country, or is it marginal?
I would say like maybe 20%.
Okay.
Yeah. Although even within those 20%, they would say they ask for it, but they wouldn't really support it. So you have this whole thing. You know what? It happened. The Americans were asking for it. They deserve it. But they don't go out and say, well, I support this. We should do more. Or something like that. They just understand it and accept it.
They understand the idea that American were provoked it by their the empire-like actions.
Yes.
And to be honest, there are those, even in France, and I guess, you know, it's a common idea around the world, that think along the same lines. They might be a lot less numerous in France, but they do exist. All right, the big part of the story now in the U.S. was it? How was it? Again, I'm going to say celebrated. God, I'm terrible. Jen, how was it? How did you live the 9/11 anniversary. Hello? Oh, apparently Jen isn't here anymore. Let me bring her back.
What did you do to her, Patrick?
I didn't do anything.
Yeah, right. Like, I don't even know you.
Wait a second. Kerwin, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. Can I do it like this? I think I can do it like this.
I think that might work.
It's ringing. But she's not here. She's not answering. What's happening?
She's not allowed to talk about how it was commemorated
apparently,
in the US.
Yeah. All right. So it was. She went offline. I'm guessing she's going to come back, hopefully soon. But until then, maybe we can talk about the Afghan election and war, and because you know it goes along with the. Oh, there she is. She's coming back. Okay. So she's back.
I'm back.
So we were just asking how the 9/11 events anniversary went in the U.S. because obviously it wasn't a big deal for the three of us.
Stop yeah. asking her. They're just going to disconnect her again.
No, obviously somebody doesn't want to hear my answer. No, I think it was actually less this year than in previous years. I think part of that just has to do with the fact that we have a new administration that's not sort of making that their badge of honor. So that in some ways kind of controlled the conversation a bit. I think part of it is that it has started to really seep into our history now as just something that is part of our identity. And so it's not as, we don't spend as much time as a culture kind of mulling over it and, you know, sort of tearing our hair out asking why did this happen to us. I think it's now become part of our own identity. And I think you're right. And part of this is that in 10 years, of course, I think we're going to see some really major stuff. I mean, there was news coverage. I didn't see, like you were saying, I didn't see a whole lot of remembrance television shows. Like it used to be that you couldn't turn the TV on without some big, huge remembrance coming on. And I'd say this time it only saturated about 50% compared to previous.
So that's still pretty significant, though.
It is. But I think that that's going to be something that, I mean, just as America, we like to sort of have things to rally around, and that's going to be one for quite some time. But I did notice it markedly less than in previous years. I mean, part of this also was that I had been out of the country for a few years and then came back, and it was definitely a lot less than when from before I left the U.S.
So you're not over it yet, but maybe my feeling is that we're going to get another spike for the 10-year anniversary, and then we will,
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that situation. And I think also, like Turkey was saying, he raised a good point. It is, we do have sort of two very different feelings around 9/11. We're very stratified as in our public opinion of it. And so you're going to have a lot of people, I think, that are clinging to this 9/11, especially now as we seem to be moving in a slightly more progressive direction politically. And so you're going to see a lot of the country start flaming, you know, sort of fueling that flame from the other side. But at the same time, there is the more progressive side of the country is more interested in moving on and solving a lot of the really pressing issues. I mean, there was something going around about how 9/11 killed about 3,000 people, but more than that die from lack of access to healthcare and that sort of thing. So there are people that have a little wider view and people who are going to want to go back and cling to that in order to avoid that wider view, I think.
So you mean to say that maybe the healthcare debate is taking the fire away from 9/11?
Yeah, I think the healthcare debate on one side of it, and I think on the other side of it, the this conservative backlash against Obama and the just the, it's, you know, we've sort of lost a compass as to having what a real debate is in a lot of ways in this country with the way the conversations have been going. And so I think 9/11 is, it's just, it's a piece of historical fact now, and it's not being leveraged politically like it was in the past.
Right.
So, yeah.
Shireen in the chat room is saying something interesting. He or she, I'm sorry, is saying, I think the Obama administration might make 9/11 a federal holiday by 2011 in time for the election. That could happen. It would be an interesting move, but that would definitely cement it as a part of your history, as you were saying.
Well, Americans definitely don't need more holidays.
They have less than we do in France.
They need a lot of holidays.
Yeah, I was going to say, we need more holidays. We need actual holidays that are just for the sake of, hey, you know what? You don't have to work that hard. That would be better.
Oh, come on. Are you trying to turn European there?
Definitely not. We can see that with the healthcare debate, or if you can call that a debate. But let's talk about the Afghan war for a minute. With the election in Afghanistan and with wild claims of irregularities in the election, it was a time, at least in France, for maybe not reconsidering, but reflecting on the tenets of the Afghan war. And, you know, Iraq is pretty much done for now. The troops are being retired. And, well, of course, it's going to take a lot of time. And it's still a very important issue. But we're sort of in the downside of the huge mountain that it was. Mm-hmm. And the Afghan war is still going on. And in France, we had a few soldiers who fell in the Afghan war in the past months. And the feeling here is that we had to question it again. But generally, the feeling is the Afghan war is still the good war. And the Taliban's are getting stronger and stronger again. But there's not a feeling that we can actually win it in by any sense of the word, but we still need to be there and prevent the Taliban's from taking a complete hold of the country like they did before 9/11. So however adverse we were to the Iraq war, the Afghan war is still considered, you know, the one that we should be doing and that we should be redirecting our resources to, even when some soldiers are actually die in there. And I know that Obama was taking a lot of flack for not taking the people out of Afghanistan as he did for Iraq, or as he laid out the plan for Iraq. How is it seen today, the Afghan war, in the U.S.?
And the U.S. public opinion is fairly strong in support of the Afghan war. However, the political thought about how to carry out that Afghan war is really split. And Obama is really between a rock and a hard place, basically, because he can either, I mean, he's basically coming up to a situation where he's going to have to make a decision, and that's going to be within the next couple of weeks. We're really going to be seeing an actual plan laid out, and he's deciding whether or not to put more troops in there or to start pulling out. And it's pretty much a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation politically for him. They've got, on one side, you've got support for, especially on the Republican side, you have support for putting more troops in there. And you have, on the Democratic side, support for pulling out. And there's valid arguments, actually, for both sides of it. But he's basically stuck. And I probably predict that he's going to be continuing to pursue it. It is still, like, public opinion does consider it, I guess, quote-unquote, a morally justifiable war to be in.
So it's not Iraq. It's not being lumped in with...
Yeah, it's not being lobbed in with Iraq. And I mean, for the most part, this Afghan war has been going on longer than the Iraq war, but it has been off our radar pretty much until just this year, you know? So it's like we haven't even really been giving much thought to the Afghan war. Everyone was thinking, oh, things are going fine over there. They must be fine. And people weren't realizing that it just, you know, that place has been falling apart because all the attention was focused on Iraq. And Whether that's because we actually have more money invested in Iraq and we, you know, all that sort of stuff that's going on there, it's hard to say. But the now that Iraq is definitely waning, as you were saying, it's definitely coming down the hill and it's coming off the radar more. We're starting to realize, oh, there's this huge mess that's probably a bit more reaching in its implications than Iraq was. It's hard to say. But yeah, it's just only recently joined or gotten back on the radar this past year.
Right. And it's pretty unwinnable. There's no way to make it, to bring it to a point where you can say, all right, we've fixed Afghanistan, now we can go home. So yeah, rock in a hard place, as you were saying.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's never been a winnable place to be. No one's ever been able to handle that. And, you know, it's a land war in Asia. So what can you say?
Kerwin, what about the UK?
I think one of the issues that has come out of it recently in the UK is that there's a grassroots motion in the Labour Party to try and convince Gordon Brown to pull troops out of Afghanistan unilaterally. The whole UK policy in Iraq and Afghanistan has been seen by the population as part of the Tony Blair and Gordon Brown premierships coalition with the US government, and really has no connection with what the Labour Party believes or what the people in the UK believe in general.
Do away with the Afghan war. They're thinking, okay, now we're done in Iraq, we have to be done in Afghanistan also.
I don't think they're making that connection. I think they, it's not that they say that we're done in Iraq or we're done in Afghanistan. I think they believe that the UK is fighting a US war, not a UK war. And there's no reason for British soldiers to be dying in Afghanistan. And they should simply be brought home.
Interesting. I guess it's not the exact same case in France. We don't see it maybe because we were strong opponents of the Iraq war to begin with.
Are there large French troop numbers in Afghanistan?
I don't know if you can say large, but they've been there from the start, and they're seen as justified. I guess that's a major difference. Yeah. Not justified in the sense that we're fighting alongside the U.S. It's sort of almost like we should be there no matter what. Even if the U.S. wasn't there, well, we wouldn't be there if the U.S. wasn't there. I'm not saying we're deluded like this, but it's a justified conflict in and of itself, and the fact that the U.S. is implicated in it has nothing to do with it. To an extent. Turkey, anything about this? Or you've been very silent, I'm worried.
Well, there's not much here about Afghanistan other than just normal news coverage of the whole situation, since it doesn't really affect us that much. So there's not that much of interest. Unlike Iraq, where we have borders, there's a whole movement of terrorists between the borders and so on. So for us, Afghanistan is kind of far, far away place.
So sort of irrelevant for you guys.
Yeah, it's just general news. We just watched the general news. What happened? There was elections. There's a problem with elections. There are some bombings here and there, but it's not like something people are keeping track of or keep making a big deal of.
All right. Last topic in the international stories, and maybe some things, something that the Saudis care a little bit more about. That's the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, which was fairly surprising, at least to me personally, because when it started, there were two main tenets of the summit. The first one was the ecological issues and the reduction of emissions, carbon emissions for the on a worldwide scale, which hasn't really evolved too much at this point. And the second one was the reforming of the world economy. And we started from a place that was, they are never going to get anything done about this. And two things they wanted to get done was, one, the tax havens, they wanted to get rid of these. When I say they, it was mostly France and Europe wanted to go there and have their plan accepted by everyone else. So it was tax havens, and bonuses for traders and bankers and people like this. And a few days ago, we were thinking they are never going to get anything done. And two or three days ago, we were floored to hear that they got a plan together, signed and accepted by everyone, a little bit on the shy side for the tax havens. But things like Switzerland, for example, which is quite important for us, have accepted to open their books, basically, when it's necessary, you know, required by law, when they would keep everything hidden before. And the bigger thing is the bonuses, which is a huge symbol for us. They are going to regulate the bonuses of traders and bankers in a sense that will make them not as reliant on immediate success. So less risk-taking. They will calculate the bonuses on longer periods of, I think, something around 3 years as opposed to quarter to quarter or semester to semester, which seems like something that is going in the right direction. And again, like something that is completely unexpected. We really thought that they would not agree to it on a worldwide, at least not the 20 countries. So this came as a complete surprise to us, and I have the feeling that although we're not, we don't have like childlike hopes that everything is going to get fixed in 3 months, it's still something, and something pretty significant. So that's the way we're seeing it. Let's start with Turkey.
Well, for us, the G20 is basically the only big deal about is that we're members in it. So, other than Saudi saying, well, we're with the big guys now, so yeah.
So it's like you're playing with the adults you're at the big poker table, and that's enough for you guys?
Yeah, for us, that's enough. We really don't care that much.
Well, do those changes affect you in any way, the traders and...
Not really that much. Saudi economy is kind of unique. It's one of the least affected economies of the world since the crisis happened. So it's kind of independent in its own self. It doesn't really get that much affected. The most effect we get is with the currency jumping because we're linked to the dollar. So when the dollar goes down, our currency goes down. And when the dollar goes up, our currency goes up. So beyond that, there's really not that much interest in what's going on because I think there's a few different reasons. One of them, of course, is our experience with the UN and so on and so on. It's just talk and talk and nothing comes out of it. So people really don't bother anymore to worry about it.
So do you liken the G20 to the UN like it's just talk?
I think it's less talk. It's more work done than the UN because this is all about finance. It's about money. People really want money. Countries want money. It's not about peace and war and humanity and
all that crap. So,
yeah, all of that so crap, whatever you want. So when it comes to money, people do care much more. So, but the whole thing is people really don't care unless they see something from the G20 that affects Saudi Arabia. That's the day they start to keep an eye on it. Until that day, they just, well, we're just with the big 20. Good for us. Hooray.
All right. So I guess the people who are the most affected are going to be the people in Wall Street, hence the U.S. And we were expecting the U.S. to fight this the most, even though Obama has been saying, you know, we need to change things. I wonder if it was seen as a victory from the dirty socialists that we are in Europe.
That remains to be seen because, you know, as much as Obama's going to make these promises, it's Congress that's going to have to carry these promises out. And so it's really going to come down. And he did actually, even though it was a sort of this idea of the regulations, it did, you know, both the UK and the US were sort of pushing for lighter regulation of these caps. And I think they ended up winning out a bit on that argument in that they're basing it now on a percentage of the assets of the banks in question rather than a hard cap, which was, I think, what France was looking for. And that's partially because Obama knows that stuff ain't going to fly back here, quite frankly. It's kind of sad, but...
Does it mean that in percentage it is going to fly?
I think it's going to be tough to make it work here in the U.S., unfortunately, and not because it shouldn't work, but because the lawmakers that are going to be responsible for carrying this out are in the pockets of those people that they are trying to regulate at the moment. And that's
Is that your feeling? I'm guessing you're one of Kerwin's friends, so you're probably fairly liberal.
Yeah.
Is that your feeling, or do you think that the people in general feel an adverse reaction to, you know, the traders and the financial institutions? Is it still sore as, you know, the crash that we knew was attributed to those people, and they still feel like they were responsible and they should be disciplined? Or have we gone back to free enterprise, you know, we should be able to do whatever we want without government.
You know, it's a really schizophrenic conversation in terms of how the U.S. sees it, because, yes, there's a lot of moral outrage over the fact that, you know, this sort of crisis came about. There's a perception that it's completely out of our sort of hands, if that makes sense.
Kind of, but
like as citizens, that it wasn't us that did it. It was these bankers and these traders and these hedge funds and all that sort of thing that sort of brought the crisis about, and that our behavior, our own personal fiscal responsibility would make no difference. So there's a bit of moral outrage that way. But on the other side of it, there is right now a lot of tension around government regulation and big government and all this. And this is all part of that larger thing, whether it be healthcare reform and all these other sorts of things. So there's this real sort of there's a bias against having the government step in and regulate things at the same time. So it's kind of a tension thing that where people don't really realize that you can't have one without the other and these sorts of things. I do think that the people will generally be very happy to have some regulation in place. I think that the 49% of the country that is all about the idea of conservative, the economic conservativeness, which is that if you let the businesses regulate themselves, people will be better off. I think they're going to have some problems with it, but the general populace, I think, after this crisis will be okay with it. Mm-hmm. But again, I think the carrying out of this whole thing by the lawmakers is really going to be the challenge.
Mm. So basically, it's not going to get done.
I'll be really surprised to see if it gets done quickly and easily. I'll be very surprised see it not be held up in Congress.
Kerwin, you've been very silent. And by the way, guys, you can interrupt me or one another. Feel free to jump in when you have something to say. But Kerwin, you've been silent. What do you think of all this?
We're just too polite. I'm not sure what to think about the bonuses yet because, again, like Jen, it needs to pass through legislation. And as it stands, I don't
think
the banking
culture has
learned anything.
Do you think it's going to be an issue in the UK
also? I think it already is a little bit with the general public, but I don't see any signs from the banking industry here that they've really learnt the lesson. I think a lot of the banking industry, a lot of bankers kind of talk about the financial crisis in this strange detached way where it was this strange accident, this calamity that affected the country, but not instigated by them in particular. They kind of don't see any fault. No one could see this coming. And therefore,
they are the ones
going to be punished.
They are the ones who profited the most out of this crisis, because when the stocks were at their lowest, they started buying like crazy.
Which banks? So who are you talking about?
No,
in this
I'm talking
case?
About traders in general, like people in the banking industry. I have at least two or three friends who told me.
Right.
Personally, they knew that, you know, it was the lowest for, you know, the stock market was at the lowest, and they started buying. And I just saw a story where they were saying that they are selling now and making a killing.
Yeah, well, but I would take that with a grain of salt. There are still a lot of traders who lost large sums of money. I think perhaps individual bankers.
I just believe anything I hear.
I think individual bankers and individual traders have been smart and protected themselves. And I remember 2 years ago talking to bankers here, and there's a lot of talk about running into moving all of their money into gold and moving how to move their money into various accounts so that they have protection of the guaranteed individual deposits. The deposit guarantee that the government was putting on individual bank accounts, they would be able to profit from that a number of times by having a number of bank accounts and things like that. So I think that they have understood best how to protect themselves in general, but they have suffered largely as well. There have still been huge layoffs in the banking sector in this country. There are still a lot of bankers who have decided to give themselves an extended holiday. I think the difference between layoffs in the banking sector and layoffs, say, in the manufacturing sector is that bankers can afford to spend a year out of work in a lot of cases, even people as young as myself, 25, 27 years old.
You're not a banker, though.
I'm not a banker, but I must admit, despite my liberal inclinations, I do consort with a lot of bankers. It's somewhat inevitable. It's the largest industry in this city.
Right. Okay.
I just wanted to say, I think that the one of the good points you raised, Kerwin, was just that the actual structural parts of the system that are really causing a lot of these problems are not being solved by this idea of capping bonuses for bankers. That's really just kind of a show just to say we're slapping them on the wrist and we're going to make them feel bad, you know?
Well, it does prevent a measure of risk-taking, which is the heart of the issue, at least that's how I understood it. If you're not looking for a quick win, then you're going to be taking more precautions in your investments.
But you can still get huge high yields on investments through high risk-taking that, you know, this whole credit swap, the default credit swap schemes and things like that that are still built into the structure of the market right now that are completely unregulated, you can still get lots of bank from those kinds of activities. You're just not going to get an extra bonus on top of it for yielding on top for your company. And this is really, that's talking about bankers that are trading with a lot of the major, that are working for a lot of these major financial institutions. There are still smaller financial institutions that operate on those high risk schemes just to get the money from that yield.
Right. It does make sense. So basically, we're still all screwed.
I wanted to talk about the G20 in a slightly larger sense, because in Australia, the G20 has been turned into a very big diplomatic event, or rather the current Prime
right,
Minister.
For the people who didn't notice it from your accent, you're actually originally from Australia.
Yes, I am. But that was a long time ago. But so, and I still follow the news quite closely in Australia, but Kevin Rudd, who's been the new Prime Minister for the last year and a half, nearly 2 years, who really prides himself on his foreign diplomatic credentials, he was formerly the ambassador to China, he has been trying to sell the G20 as an incredible coup for Australia's middle power diplomacy in the world. The thing that's been decided, which is that the G20 should be the world's head economic cooperation body, not the G7. So it's important for Australia not only that Australia is now part of the G20, but also that Australia's two of Australia's largest trading partners, India and China, are now in the G20. And on top of that, one of the most populous neighbours and Australia's most important economic neighbour, which is Indonesia, is now part of the G20. So for Australia, it's not simply that their voice is being heard at a much more systematic level in world governance, but also that in some ways the centre of economic power is formally shifting to the east. The G7 was very much a Eurocentric or a North Atlantic body, and the G20 has Brazil, India, China, Indonesia, South Korea on board.
So basically it's a huge party in Sydney now.
It's not a huge party in Sydney. I think it's a huge party in the Prime Minister's office. I think Kevin Rudd is specifically trying to sell it as this, and I think the rest of the country's journalism is agreeing on this fact that this growing role is important for Australia, but still trying to maintain just a middle power band. We don't want to get our neck stuck out so far that we suffer another Bali bombing.
Well, you know, it's pretty significant also that, as you were saying, it's becoming the major economic forum. And I know it's a lot of people tend to mock these organizations, as, you know, Turkey was just talking about the UN, and how all of this is evil and it doesn't work and no one cares anyway and it doesn't influence our lives. But on the scale of history, it does. I think it does good, and I've been saying this about the UN for a while. And this pretty much shows that you were saying it's shifting the economic power to the east.
Yes.
It's and that's true, and that's, for lack of a better word, you might call me a you know, hippie or something, dreamer, but it is more fair. It seems more fair, you know, that the world's power, economic power, has shifted. And now it's being represented more fairly. And this is something that is not obvious, that you, if you had a choice, if we, the people, you know, the few countries that did have the actual deciding power, could help it, maybe it wouldn't have gone this way. But the organization and the structure of these organizations are so that it does happen and it does move and it does become something a little bit more fair. And even if it takes, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, it does happen. And in the scope of history, 30 years is not that long.
I think it's true to say that it's more fair, but I think it's not uncontroversial. I think the issue is not so much that these other countries get more power, but the fear that the existing G7 countries, UK, US, France, Italy, Germany, get less power on the world scene. And when, if the people in those countries start to feel that their economies are in any way being dictated to by the likes of Mexico or Turkey or India, I think then that's when it'll become a really populist issue.
Well, I think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to be really Mexico or Turkey. It's going
to
be
pick a few.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's going to happen, and there are going to be adverse feelings in our old powers, you know, probably France, Germany, UK first, and then maybe even the US and others. But my point is, it is going to happen, and the power maybe not is not going to shift, but these countries are going to rise. But what would happen in a different time would be a war to actually get heard and, you know, grab the power. And now it's getting dealt with in other forms that are more civilized and, you know, good.
That's very true. I think a lot of these world government organizations are still very experimental, and I think it will take the world another 100 years, perhaps, to get used to it.
So maybe we will get to a world where we have a forum like in Star Trek, where people are actually peaceful and have decided. You know, we're making fun of
God,
this.
You're such a dreamer.
I think it's possible, and I don't think it's unrealistic. I think it's a type of political technology that we have to learn how to develop, the nation state system that we have, which some people might call the Westphalian system. And so the Westphalian Treaty was the middle of the 19th century, right? And it took maybe 100 years. It took to the end of the World War II for the nation state as a real entity to become universal, the collapse of colonialism especially.
Exactly. I mean, it was very transitional in the before World War II, and it came to that system after World War II, when people started saying, let's get together and talk. And, you know, NATO and the UN and these bodies were started only 50 or 60 years ago. And that's very, very recent, very new. And it's still in its infancy. So, Turkey, you're being cynical. Why not one day have a wonderful world where everyone talks and no one fights?
How long have humanity been on this earth?
Let's say 10,000 years.
Okay, when were they all peaceful and loving?
Well, that's my point. That's my point.
It's human nature. It'll never happen. There's this whole Star Trek fantasy.
No, hey, listen. Let's,
it's also human nature to improve its lot, and statistically, compared to the current world population.
It improves, but it will never be peaceful and in harmony.
Hey, listen, look at Europe.
People.
Look at Europe. What the European leaders did after World War II. They said, we are civilized people. We shouldn't be shooting each other's anymore. Let's get together and talk. And that's what they did. And can you imagine today, with the economies being so intertwined, a war starting between, let's say, France and Germany, or France and the UK, or France and
well,
Spain?
I'll remind you if it happens during your lifetime.
All right.
It's also, to be fair, I mean, you know, you're talking about sort of these countries that are not in a crisis of resources or a crisis. I mean, you know, European Union got together at being fairly rich countries and then slowly adding in the poorer countries to let them be richer too. But, you know, if you're looking around the world and you see where all the conflicts are centered, they're centered in places where, you know, resources are being just completely demolished and being pulled out of places and things like that. So I think the key word here is fair. And right now we, you know, the conflicts are kind of coming down in places where there's more fairness. I still think that we as a Western, a generally Western-centric society, we still have a lot to learn about how to be fair to societies that aren't built on the same models that we are. And I think that's when we're going to start seeing a reduction of war and
well,
that sort of thing.
I would say we have to wait for them to catch up. And they are catching up at a rate that is unbelievable. I mean, look at China, look at India. They were medieval 50 years ago, and now they are,
Patrick,
basically
there are 6 billion people on this earth.
Yes,
do you think this earth can handle 6 billion people, and that the resources are not going to be dwindling for these 6 billion that will soon become 7 and 8 and 9 and 10, and then countries are going to start fighting over the resources?
I believe there is a way. I believe
there
is a way. Yes, I think there is a way that we can all... what you're saying, Jen, is very true. I mean, resources are definitely the heart of war, but I think there is a way that we can have enough resources for everyone. And it's going to be a challenge, but I think it's possible.
Yeah, I completely agree. But when you look at a country like America that consumes more than its fair share of resources of the world, I mean, we have the resources in this world to feed everybody now. But what it comes down to is distribution and... And, you know, like, and you're looking at a country like America, we would have to take on the responsibility of lowering our consumption and being, you know, choosing more the fair trade and all these other things that are going on. And that's a huge cultural shift. I think what's great is that we're laying political groundwork, like the idea of what you're saying, these countries, these nation states coming together and forming organizations that are superior to the nation states. That's fantastic. But the cultural shifts that are eventually going to be necessary are huge, I think.
I agree, but I think that it's not going to be that we have to Bill Maher says, if you asked Americans to save the world by putting down their remote control, like if putting down your remote control and having to get up to the TV to change the channel could actually save the world, they wouldn't do it. And I think that's partly true. But I think that we're not going to have to. I believe that, you know, be it through nuclear power, not nuclear, but nuclear power, and, or solar power or whatever, we're going to have enough for everyone. I believe so. I hope that we're going to have enough water. I hope that the world doesn't explode. I hope that the, you know, climate change is not going to get the best of us. But I think it's possible. Will it happen? I don't know. But I think it's possible,
well,
and that we will rise everyone to the level of
comfort. Make sure that it won't happen.
Who?
Sitting there and just hoping doesn't mean that it won't happen.
Hey, I'm doing my part. I'm doing shows like this to better understanding and comprehension among the people of the world. What did you do?
I definitely agree that it could happen.
I criticize people. That's what
and that's what we like about you, Turkey. All right, let's move on to another issue that's related.
I just want to clarify. Oh, yes. I feel I need to defend myself, or rather correct myself. The Treaty of Westphalia was 1648, not in the 1800s, which means it won't take us 100 years to solve world government. It'll take us 350.
All right. That's still reasonable in the 10,000 years.
That's still attainable.
Yeah. Well, we won't be here
around
to see it.
Oh, we might be.
We might. You know, there are people who believe that we are going to be able to reverse aging in like 20 years. So
that's right.
Transhumanists and all that.
Yeah, we might. So local stories. Let's do one per person because we're already over the time that I thought we would need. One for France is a sort of depressing story, which is a carbon tax that the current right-wing government is trying to put in place after years and years and years of everyone trying to say we need a carbon tax to incentivize the industries to, you know, burn less, you know, release less carbon in the atmosphere and do something about global warming. Finally, we're proposing a carbon tax, and the parliament is basically threatening not to pass it because the right wing is saying, well, it's not really what we need, but they're sort of falling in line with what the president wants them to do, because the president Sarkozy is, you know, it's his party in power, and it's right wing. And the left wing is sort of by principle saying we don't want that because God knows why. But all in all, what it comes down to is it might not go through. And I don't understand what's happening here, because it's basically a tax that everyone agrees we need. Everyone in the country and everyone in the world says that's the kind of thing we need. It might not be the exact amount that they think we need, and it might not be, you know, the right way to do it exactly, but it would definitely be a step in the right direction, and a step that almost no one else in the Western world, except maybe those crazy Nordic people, have taken.
Socialists, all of them.
Why are you so surprised, Patrick? You just passed the law, the three strike law for the internet.
Yes.
And you're surprised about them not wanting to pass this one?
Because it is a law that basically, the reason why I'm surprised is, it's a law that the left should have voted in. Because they are traditionally the people who are the more concerned with that sort of thing. And now the president, who is from the right, is saying we need to pass this. So he has basically the vote of the right, and the left should be the ones saying, yes, we need that too, so we should come together and do it. And so it would be one of those rare occasions when people go, okay, we actually need it, so let's go ahead and do it. And somehow,
how are the politicians going to be paid from the companies if they're going to vote against them?
Against the companies, you mean?
Yeah.
We don't have as big a lobbying issue in France as they have in the U.S., so it's not as big a problem. They could actually pass it. Now it's just a reaction, I think, of the left to the right on principle, that they, you know, want to be against the right. But it might pass anyway. But I would be ecstatic if it did, because it would be, as a French citizen, saying we actually did something and I can feel good about this on a global level. But sorry, Jen, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I would totally support a carbon tax. But I think also what usually happens whenever you're dealing with any situation where economies are tanking, it's very hard to push new legislation that is about taxing things, you know?
Well, they're supposed to do, you know, compensation in income tax to change this. And,
you know,
in France, we're not the shyest people about taxing stuff, so.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. It's just very...
My own little cultural lens there.
It's also a place where I don't think the business lobby in France is going to be particularly against the tax. As you say, it's not the business lobby in France isn't as strong, but... Also, I think it's fairly well prepared for the introduction of a carbon tax. It's waiting for the government to institute it. There's a lot of some of the largest companies involved in the logistics of recycling and things like that, such as Veolia, which are based in France. I think the French business is ahead of the politics. So I don't think that that's the factor.
Which is why it's so frustrating that they're bickering so much. But anyway, hopefully they will pass it through, and I can tell you in a few months, we are leading the way in fighting the global warming in France.
I thought Norway was leading the way.
Yes, well, okay. They don't count. All right, so that was me. I'm guessing you haven't even heard of this tax. So let's just move on to something else that's very happy about, which was what you told me about Turkey. What happened in Saudi Arabia in the past few weeks?
Well, we have a lot of things that happened.
I was talking about the university, but...
University. All right. We have a new university in Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. It was inaugurated last Wednesday on the National Day, the Saudi National Day, on the same day it's celebration. And it's the biggest and one of the most advanced universities in the world. You can compare it to MIT, hopefully. That's the idea behind it. It's a graduate research university. It covers 32 kilometers. And the biggest news, which is apparently the feminist Patrick wants me to mention, is this is the first university in Saudi Arabia where genders are allowed to mix together in classes and in the hallways, and where the veil is not mandatory for women.
Which is amazing. It's absolutely huge. I mean, I saw the pictures you posted on Twitter, Turkey, and you mentioned, you know, the extremists in the country are probably not going to be happy about this.
But they're definitely not happy.
Yeah.
But this is a huge project, and it carries the name of the king, and it's done by the king himself and organized by him, and it's his personal project. So he can do some things, and not many people can even do anything about it. They can't just sit there and go against the king. So that's the difficulty. Also, the whole university is a city itself, so and it's a fenced city, so there is a limited access to it. It's closed on itself, but it's a very, very nice place. So that kind of makes things a little easier. If it was an open university, free access, then we would really have some problems.
Is this a social experiment that will expand in any way, or is this really kind of the exception that proves the rule?
I would say this is an exception for the next at least minimum 10 years. I don't expect any changes for at least 10 years, and that's an optimistic number. So this will be an exception for at least 10 years. And it's a very, very nice university. It's a huge deal here. Patrick is more interested on the feminist part.
I'm not interested on
the technology and science part. It's a huge research university. We brought professors and doctors from around the world. 15% of the students are Saudi, only 15%. There are 8% Americans, I think, and there's about 12% Chinese, and there's about 65 nationalities in this university. And there are huge contract deals with huge companies around the world for research in that university. And they got one of the fastest supercomputers in the world. I think it's ranked number 14 and the fastest in the Middle East.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm only interested in the feminist side of it, although I think it's very important.
I didn't say only. I said that's the most part you're interested
in. Well, I think it's a very important symbol. And a lot of people say, well, you know, I remember a few people commented on the blog and said, you know, you have to do it faster and you have to condemn the countries where they treat women like this or where they do this and that. And we say again and again, it's not that easy and it goes slowly. And this is a definitely very important step in my mind towards changing things. And you have to imagine it's not going to change things in 2 days or in 1 year or 2 years, as you were saying, Turkey, but it does influence the general social climate in the country when you have steps like this. And when the king is showing such a strong message, And you, the pictures you were showing were women and men colluding in classes with no veil and just talking to one another. That's pretty big.
Yeah. Yeah, the veil is optional, and Abdullah is mentioning, of course, that women will be allowed to drive in the campus area, in the university town.
Yeah.
So that's another step for them.
And that's it's not going to change in 2 minutes, but it breeds a different generation is the most important thing. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really big thing, and it's such a huge project, and there's so much interest in it from the king. It's a 32 kilometer area, and the entire university was built in 3 years. Exactly. Wow. 3 years. He just announced it 3 years ago. I want the university. 3 years later, it's ready and it's launching.
So that's what happens when you don't have regulations.
I remember that announcement.
There's no in this project specifically, because it's directly to the king. So yeah. Every regulation is hitting the wall because nobody's going to say no. and the company that took care of establishing the university was Aramco, the Saudi oil company. And so Aramco has always been known as an open society. They allow gender mixes in their offices, in their compounds. Women drive inside their neighborhoods, and so on. So it's kind of the effect also of Aramco, and they're known for quality also. So it's a really
so
big.
Yeah, this is a beacon of hope in the Middle East, and hopefully we'll see more and more of those.
Hey, Patrick, I'm already looking for a job. I want to move there.
Well, yeah, certainly you can. I'm sorry, go ahead, Jen.
Oh, no, I used to work at MIT, so it'd be kind of like, oh, I could try and get a job out there. Live the good life in Saudi Arabia.
I suppose so. I guess if you want to go in Saudi Arabia, that's probably the place you want to be in.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And you should see the pictures of the campus. It's so high class. It's so nice, so beautiful. They have their own shoreline. It's on the Red Sea. They have their own marina.
Wow. All you need to do is refer them to this show, and certainly they're going to give you a job immediately. I'm sure.
Yeah, and they got a theater there. I don't know if they're going to show movies in it or is it just for the university, but we'll find out soon enough. So.
Cool. So let us know how it goes. I'm sorry. I know you had more stories you wanted to talk about Turkey, but I think we're a little short of on time.
I have one story that's important compared to this,
okay,
which is the assassination attempt against the member of the royal family. So during the holy month of Ramadan, a terrorist came and said he wanted to turn himself in, and he wanted to turn himself in personally to the deputy interior minister, who is a royal highness, and he's the son of the interior minister, and he's the head of the anti-terrorist movement. So he met with him, apparently, and the guy hid a bomb, up his ass.
Oh, wow.
And he went in, he met with the prince, and as soon as he met with the prince, he detonated the bomb and he blew himself up.
Oh, my
apparently,
God.
The prince was safe. Wow. He only got a few very minor scratches, and he only went to the hospital for a few hours and he just left. But this guy, and it's unbelievable the way the media here is sometimes unbelievable. They put the pictures and the videos on TV and on newspapers, and not all of them put a warning in the beginning.
You mean of the guy actually blowing himself up?
No, after he was blown up.
Oh, okay.
Of the guy in pieces.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, wow. So you see a foot here, a hand there, whatever, different body parts and blood, and it's unbelievable. And that was a huge, huge thing, and it really, in a way, that was a very bold move from the terrorist, and it's also one of the most stupid moves they ever did, the terrorists, because that really, because first of thing, they did it during the holy month of Ramadan, And the guy turned himself in, and he asked for amnesty and to be safe, and the prince gave him the safety, so he betrayed his word. So it's really hurting the terrorists very, very badly.
Hmm. Well, we haven't even heard of this here. When did it happen?
It happened during Ramadan. I think that's about 30 days ago.
Wow. Oh, maybe I was in the U.S. And didn't.
It wasn't even here that big of a deal. They made it a big of a deal, but people completely didn't really hang on to it too long. Like, it was for 2 or 3 days, and it just went down. But it really hurt the entire movement for the terrorist movement here. Because the way they did it, it really was horrible and unacceptable by many people. It's one thing to go and being a terrorist and blowing people, but to talk to someone, ask for your safety, ask to talk to them so you can turn yourself in, and then just blow yourself, that's just crossing the line.
Mm. All right. That's a lovely story. Maybe, Kerwin, you can tell us something about something that will make us smile a little bit more.
I've got a story that may
have
a happy ending.
Dude, I just talked about the guy who blew himself up with different body parts. Don't you play video games?
I'm not going to comment on this.
Well, okay, the story that I have to tell in the Philippines, the biggest story in the Philippines these last couple of months, it has a sad beginning and hopefully a happy ending, but I might have to give you guys a bit of background. You might remember that the Philippines was for many years ruled by a dictator called Ferdinand Marcos.
Right.
And he instituted martial law in about 1972, and in 1983, as an opposition movement was brewing, there was an exiled opposition leader called Ninoy Aquino, who decided to return from Boston to the Philippines, and as he descended from the plane, he was assassinated by henchmen of Marcos, it's believed. This basically sent the Marcos dictatorship into a free fall. And in 1986, a very strange gesture, Marcos just tried to hold a snap election, figuring that he could rig the ballots enough to show that he was still the democratic leader of the country. Instead, what happened is that there was a very close victory by the wife of Ninoy Aquino. Her name is Cory Aquino. And as Marcos's ministers saw the writing on the wall and they threw their lot in behind Cory Aquino, Marcos was forced to flee the country. So that was in 1986. Cory Aquino then, she's a very devout Catholic woman. She instituted a lot of constitutional reforms so that there would be, so presidents would be limited to one term and a few other things. She was also, she was criticized because she did not do enough to break the corruption that's endemic throughout the whole Filipino political and economic system. All right, so the news that is big in the Philippines at the moment is that I think it was in August, Cory Aquino died. And there was a massive outpouring of grief across the country. The Philippines is still an extremely devout Catholic country itself. And so Cory Aquino's color was yellow. There were yellow banners all over the cities. Every school, every town hall would have a yellow banner with her photo on it. Her body was shown in a couple of places. It was shown in some of the larger private churches, and then shown in the Manila Cathedral. And then there was a funeral procession of some 8 or 10 hours, marked by a couple of million people in Manila. Manila is a city of 10 million people. The good news that comes out of it after a succession of quite corrupt presidents that have been democratically elected since 1986, the good news is that there was a spontaneous growth of support for her son, who is Ninoy Aquino. So the father is Ninoy Aquino, the son is Ninoy Aquino. And Ninoy Aquino has been a senator for many years, but he's always largely kept out of the limelight as much as possible. And he's got a reputation for being a good legislator, which is a rare thing in the Philippine Congress. But so there's now been this movement for him to run for the presidency next year. The leading candidates to date, especially in his own party, the Liberal Party, the leading candidate, who was Mar Rojas, I think it was, decided that he would throw his support to Aquino, and Aquino finally announced officially his run for the presidency a couple of weeks ago. So what this means is that next year, when they have the election, there could be a massive popular movement again, something which unifies the country, which it's desperately needed in the last few years. And there might be a competent legislator running the country, which would be a great thing for my mother's homeland.
So you mean it would break the cycle of... have they been, you know, competent people, competent presidents in the country, and not corrupt people in the country since? Or is it,
I think it's basically gotten kind of worse and worse since Cory Aquino left the presidency in 92. After that was an army general called Fidel Ramos. Fidel Ramos was actually, I think he was defense minister in the Marcos administration. So he was still quite implicated in the corruption that surrounded Marcos. However, he was a very intelligent man and a good economic reformer. So he did manage to create a lot of growth in the country. After him was a B-grade film star called Jose Estrada. Estrada was famous for having strings of mistresses around the country, for having these massive drinking sessions where he and his buddies would, on a whim, write presidential decrees at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the next day they'd have to be handed for him so he could unsign them. His presidency lasted, I think, maybe not even 3 years, because he was impeached and then he was basically chased out of the country for his flagrant incompetence and corruption. And the person who replaced him, though, was the current president, who is Gloria Macapagal. So she was the vice president at the time, and so she's since been re-elected once, and she's coming to the end of her term. Gloria Macapagal was strongly criticized by Cory Aquino herself for having raised corruption in the presidency to new heights, especially through Gloria Macapagal's husband, who's called the First Gentleman, I believe. So the First Gentleman has been exploiting his access to the presidential palace to garner a lot of wealth for the Macapagal family in office. And the fear is that when Macapagal leaves presidency, or their own fear is that they are going to be thrown a whole lot of corruption charges, both in the Philippines and in the US, where there are some corruption proceedings in a couple of states against Mike Macapagal.
Well, that's, I guess, good news in the end.
Yes, sir. So the good news is that I think that there will be a strong upswell for Noynoy Aquino, someone who carries his mother's sense of ethics, but has learned from her failures as a legislator.
And he also has a funny name. So
he has no name. And, ladies, he's still single.
Ooh.
Ladies. All right. Good. By the way, I haven't heard about this. Maybe it's because I didn't pay enough attention to international news, but haven't heard about any of this in France. So maybe we don't care enough.
I think the Philippines is off most people's radars. It's even off most people's radars in the Southeast Asia where it's located.
Jen, what's happening in your part of the world?
Oh, you see, now I'm feeling all challenged to come up with something that you haven't heard of. But, well... I'd say the big thing going on here is, of course, our healthcare reform. And sort of as you were saying about the carbon tax, I'm kind of scratching my head about this whole thing where we have a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, and yet we still can't seem to get this thing right. and push through. But the healthcare debate is, it continues on, and it's caused a lot of sort of changes of the climate. As can be demonstrated by the 9/12 march on Washington. You may have heard of a guy named Glenn Beck.
Oh my God.
yeah. He's a shining beacon of conservative pundit. So yeah, the 9/12 march happened. They claim 1.5 million people marched. They're guessing it's about 60 to 70,000 people were there.
Wait. So Fox News is saying 1.5 million?
Million, yeah.
And the authorities are saying 70,000?
Yeah, thereabouts. Yeah, in fact, there was even a false photo that was released claiming that this was showing the mall being filled and the main street that goes down past the mall being filled with people, and it turned out to be a photo from 5 years ago because there was a missing building in the photo. And then you may have seen in that. Some of the coverage of that, the signs that have been shown, healthcare.
What were they marching for?
Well, you know, a lot of people were marching for a lot of different reasons, it turns out. It was spurred by the healthcare debate. There was a lot of stop big government, we don't want to be socialists, and a lot of really violent racist rhetoric about Obama.
They were pissed off there was a black man in the White House.
But they're telling you that's not what it's about. They're saying, oh no, it's the issues. But when you start seeing things like pictures of Obama on placards dressed as a tribesman with a bone through his nose, you kind of think that's kind of racist, you know?
just a little bit.
Call me strange. But so there's a lot of debate now about the role of race in the conversation, and it's kind of turned everything into a big mess in a lot of ways. And unfortunately, what the biggest casualty of that is the healthcare debate. So the latest that we're at is that we're trying to pass a bill that includes what's called a public option, which would be that the government becomes an insurance provider, so that they would be competing with the private insurance providers. Even that now is at a risk, and it may turn out that this big healthcare reform bill will be just a few more regulations on the insurance company, and that's it.
Do you think that's because of that 9/12 project by Glenn Beck?
Oh, no. I think the 9/12 project is just an indication of where the conversation is going in a lot of this and where the rhetoric is going. I think it's going to be a real indication as to how our next couple of election cycles are going to run. And, you know, we've had a really horrible time of it with misinformation in elections, and I think it's just gotten a lot worse through this. I think what's really moving and driving the healthcare debate right now is the insurance lobby, and they are winning at this point. And so there's even what we call, I don't know if you've heard of a term called blue dog Democrats, but these are Democrats. Yeah, these are Democrats that are more fiscally conservative. And a few of the blue dogs, there's one that was implicated in receiving huge payouts from United Health. And surprise, surprise, he happens to be against the public option right now. Things like that have been going on. So it's unfortunate, but it seems to be that we'll be lucky at this point if our healthcare reform involves government-supported insurance. That'll be the best we can hope for, and even that right now seems a bit risky.
Can I ask a question about this debate then? Is there... Because I think outside the U.S., in most of the countries I've lived in, there's a general consensus that the U.S. health system is extremely unjust. But is there not that same consensus within the U.S.? Like, what kind of proportions of people think it's the worst healthcare system in the Western world? What proportion think it's the best healthcare system in the world?
There's a not in my backyard mentality to this, and it pretty much splits pretty evenly. The voters that are in favor of reforming and having a public, or at least increasing access to healthcare, are the ones that don't have healthcare. And the ones that are in favor of keeping things the way that they are the ones that do have healthcare. That's really what it comes down. There's a lot of people that in theory say that it would be great to have universal healthcare. However, they're very happy with what they have and they see no reason to change it. And that's pretty much down the public opinion lines right now.
I think it's a lot of ignorance, because the fact of the matter is, as you were saying, Kerwin, I've been saying this before, but I guess it doesn't hurt to repeat it. The healthcare system as it is in the US now, even for people who do have healthcare, is incredibly expensive and yes. is ranked, what is it, 37?
37. We're number 37.
World.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. and it you spend, I think, 16% of your gross domestic product on it, which is a lot more. Yeah, a lot more than other people. So basically, even the ones who think, what we have is great and whatever, we don't want to change it, don't realize that you're paying more for lesser service.
Yes.
And that's...
Yes.
I don't understand how people cannot get this idea. It's probably a failing on the politician's part also, which it's such a simple idea to convey. You are paying more for less, for
what it comes down to is who's controlling the conversation right now, and unfortunately the insurance lobby has the most control over this conversation. That's really what it comes down to,
which is a failing on the Democrats' part, I think.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. It's just pretty amazing that they've managed to lose control of this debate with a majority both in the administration and in Congress, and they've managed to lose control of the debate. But and it's kind of a shame. I'll be curious to see how it turns out. But you know, I've lived in situations. I've lived under the NHS. I've lived in the U.S. being not covered by healthcare. I've lived in the U.S. with a pretty darn good healthcare plan, and I would still prefer to have universal healthcare. So, yeah.
All right. Let's hope it. I'm sorry.
Oh, and I just wanted to give you one little thing to sort of chuckle at, too, just in terms of ignorance. This is just a little tiny news bit. In New Jersey, 18% of the Republican voters in New Jersey believe that Obama is the Antichrist. Just to let you know.
18%?
Of Republican voters in New Jersey.
Wow.
They entered a poll with such. So just so that you know.
That's New Jersey. It's not like...
I know.
I was going to say Alabama, but maybe I should.
Okay, but yeah, I know what you mean, though.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, with that, I think that's gonna count as our, and now for something completely different, Obama is the Antichrist, apparently. And that's going to be it for us today. I want to thank you guys
Patrick,
again.
I have one thing, yes. It's a quick history.
Okay,
lesson.
Hurry up.
Apparently, the last heir to the Ottoman Empire has just died.
Yes, I did hear about that.
Oh, I didn't know. That's terrible. It means
so
that
there'll be no restoration.
No.
Well, they might find a way. Maybe it's going to be the guy who wields the bone of the last heir to the Ottoman Empire. He's going
to be interesting.
He was the grandson of the last emperor.
Yeah.
And he died at the age of 97.
Oh. See, we were having fun with that Antichrist story, and you bring us down again.
It's Turkey, history. I'm just trying to put some history into this show.
Thank you. And I thank you for it, Turkey. All right. So that's really really it for us. You might understand that I have to be somewhere. So I'm trying mm-hmm. to hurry this along.
Yep.
Sorry.
No. We're going to keep you. You're not going anywhere.
So, again, so you can follow, you can go and comment on the blog at thephileasclub.com, which will take you to the central blog, which is frenchspin.com. You can send an email to phileas@frenchspin.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/notpatrick. You can follow Turkey at twitter.com/saudi, right?
Yep.
And anything, do you guys have websites or anything you want to pimp?
Well, I've got a Twitter account, but I'm not ready to pimp it yet. It's got a few things in it, but nothing. Yeah, I just followed you. I just started following you.
Oh, okay, cool. So I'll follow you back. And
cool.
Maybe, and yeah, so we're going to keep it secret.
And I'll start making it worth following, and then I'll pimp it out.
Good. Kerwin, what about you? Do you have a website or something?
I've got something in development, but I think it'll take a couple of months before I'm ready to announce it.
Secrets, I like it.
Secret. It'll
All
be
right.
something for the globe, for international men of mystery such as ourselves.
Good, we'll be looking forward to that. So thank you very much for being here, guys. It was a blast. I hope we will get the pleasure of having you again on the show at some point. And thank you, everyone in the chat room, for being here also. And we will talk to you listeners again in 1 month at the end of October. So talk to you soon, guys. Bye.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.